The Senate Judiciary Budget Division will come to order. Today is Tuesday, April 13th, the year 2010. And we're at the Capitol in St. Paul. We will start with number one item on the agenda, the Senate File 2880. Senator Mao, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for making the time to hear Senate File 2880. Senate File 2880 is a bill that has been brought to us by the judicial branch. It is a bill that removes the guardian ad litem program from the administrative control of the judicial branch and creates an independent agency very much like the Public Defense Board. In fact, much of the policy language to set up the structure, the governing structure, the oversight board, the composition of the oversight board is mirror after the Board of Public Defense. What is specific to and of concern to this committee, Mr. Chair and members, is the money piece of how this removal of the guardian ad litem program to this independent agency being with the creation of this independent board having oversight over this agency, how the money piece of it transfers from the judicial branch to this new independent board. And Mr. Chair, members, I believe that some of this information may have been already provided to you, but in brief, the proposal, in essence, the judicial council has made the decision to transfer the entire current base budget of $12.367 million to the board. This also, the judicial council also is going to be transferring the guardian ad litem reimbursement account, whose current balance is $2.8 million. I believe that the reimbursement account collects approximately $600,000 a year. And so whatever dollars it takes the current under the judiciary to operate the guardian ad litem program, I believe all of that money is being transferred over to the independent board. From a financial point of interest, too, I believe that the state court administrator's office is going to continue to provide, in the period of transition, administrative support. And once the transition has taken place, they're going to continue to provide other support to the board until such a time when the board determines that they could do things independently. And so the bill, as before you deals in terms of the money piece, Mr. Chair and members, is really the transfer of the base budget and the transfer of the reimbursement account to the new board.
Thank you, Senator Mao. Did you have someone else who was going to speak to this issue?
Mr. Chair and members, no. There is an amendment that the court has asked us. I believe that in the bill as introduced and as it came out of the Senate Judiciary Policy Committee, there were a couple of the monetary pieces were being decided upon, and we've made that decision as per my testimony. And so there's an A2 amendment that now will insert numbers into the blank spaces in the bill as introduced. And I also believe that the A2 amendment also speaks to the transfer of the money in the reimbursement account. But I think that the court administrator's office is here, and they could certainly speak to the A2 amendment if members would like to hear from them.
Did you wish to introduce the A2 as part of the author's first?
Mr. Chair, since the bill has already gone through the Senate Judiciary Policy Committee, I don't know that it could be done as an author's amendment. And since I'm not a member of this committee, I would greatly appreciate it if somebody would move the A2 amendment.
I'll move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
I've heard the motion, discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. Motion prevails. Are there any questions from the committee members? Comments? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak? Could you step forward and tell us your name?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Virginia Rudloff. Can you hear me? I'm the executive director of CASA Minnesota, which is a nonprofit organization that supports the volunteer guardian ad litem programs. And I myself am a volunteer guardian ad litem. This bill was written without the support or the input of guardians ad litem or guardian ad litem staff. The state court has said that this bill is fiscally neutral, and taken at face value, it is. It is difficult to talk about the budget without sounding like a bunch of whiners now that the Judicial Council has voted not to make any cuts to the guardian ad litem budget. However, the state court plans to pay for the creation of this board with funds from the existing guardian ad litem budget, a budget that does not currently include funds for an administrator, administrative assistant, or staff attorney. According to the state court, it will cost approximately $900,000 to set up this board. That's about an 8% cut in the base budget. They're counting on the fact that some districts have guardian ad litem reimbursement funds available and that they can somehow fill in the gaps caused by the district's contribution to the cost of the board. Right now, two judicial districts control the majority of those reimbursements. That means that some districts will chip in much more than others, or that others will take a deeper cut to their budgets. The reimbursement funds have built up over several years' time, so once they are spent, we cannot count on them being available in the next year. The state court believes that by cutting services to non-mandatory family court cases and somehow using more technology for communications, the programs will be able to make up the difference. Additionally, if state and district court administrations pull their support services in July 2011, the programs will have to come up with the additional money for offices, accounting and HR services, legal services, IT services, office equipment, and other expenses not currently in the guardian ad litem budget. Most guardians ad litem work out of their homes, and unless the guardian ad litem programs can come up with office space, they will also have to pay stipends for home offices. At the same time, the court has decided to transition its contractor guardians ad litem to employee guardians ad litem without any addition to the guardian ad litem budget. In order to pay the benefits for these employee guardians ad litem, the programs will hire mostly full-time guardians ad litem who carry higher caseloads. The guardian ad litem budget is already stressed to the maximum, and now it must somehow absorb the cost of creating and staffing a new board and the conversion to employees. I believe that the program staff is worried about the financial ramifications of this conversion, which doesn't occur until July 1, 2010. So we know nothing about the unanticipated costs or the outcomes. Guardians ad litem are excellent and very successful advocates for children, but they're not the best advocates for themselves. How else would you explain the fact that this bill made it all the way to this committee without finding someone to speak on behalf of guardians ad litem? This is a copy of the Secretary of State's report on state boards. There are almost 200 boards on this list, and every one of them, from architects to the Urban Initiative Board, has a majority of its own members on the board. It's standard operating procedure for state boards, and we can't seem to get anyone to listen to us. We need designated seats for guardians ad litem on this board in order to ensure that a high-quality, independent guardian ad litem program is maintained. I fear that if you pass this bill as it is written, the guardian ad litem program will be back in the legislature in 2011, begging for more money just to survive. Thank you.
Thank you. Members have any questions of the witness?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weathers, concern that there may not be a structure involved for guardian ad litems to have a professional participation, at least by this witness. Do you have anything to comment about the testimony?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lemmer, under the current structure, under current law,
The Judicial Council has the governance and oversight over the guardian ad litem program. There are no guardians involved in the current practice. There's not even an advisory committee of any sort for guardians ad litem to directly participate in the management oversight of the guardian ad litem program under current law. What this proposal does is that it creates an independent governance board. The three members are appointed by the Supreme Court, four members appointed by the governor. And we specifically provide in the language that the members who are going to be appointed by the Supreme Court and the governor shall be well acquainted with the guardian ad litem program, as well as laws that affect a guardian ad litem's work, including the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. The Supreme Court will appoint the board chair for 2 years, and we also provide that if they would like to, the board may appoint an advisory committee to assist in its duties and to report to the board on guardian ad litem issues. So I think that actually the bill creates a number of opportunities for the inclusion of guardians or individuals who are involved, have knowledge, experience with the guardian ad litem program to participate much more than what it is under current law.
Senator Mao, would you kind of go through this a little bit, the overall, or if you'd rather have someone from the court do that, or but I think the members would do well to have that information in front of them.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, Section 1, 2, and 3, and 4 of the bill deals with the fiscal issues that I referred to earlier in terms of with respect to the fees that are being transferred, where they're spent. So it deals with the transition of the money piece. Section 5 of the bill is the section that deals with the creation of the State Guardian Ad Litem Board. Subdivision 1 talks about the establishment of the board consisting of 7 members. Sub 1, 2, 1 and 2 of that talks about the 3 members appointed by the Supreme Court, 4 members appointed by the governor. Line 3.25 of the bill then talks about the specific qualifications for the candidates who shall be appointed by the Supreme Court and the governor. And the section that I specifically referred to is in line 1.27 of the bill that says the candidate shall be well acquainted with the guardian ad litem program as well as laws that affect the guardian ad litem's work, including the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. We say that at least 3 members of the board shall be from the judicial districts. Other than the 1st, 2nd, 4th, and 10th judicial district, and the rest of that section talks about terms and compensation and removal. Subdivision 2 of the bill talks about the duties and responsibilities. Subdivision 3 sets up the state program administration, the administrator, and how the transition shall take place. And then the rest of that deals with the transition period and the administration of the board. And then Section 6 comes back to deal with the fees. But, Mr. Chair, members, that's the bill.
Thank you, Senator Mao. We do have a fiscal note on that, and Mr. Turner is not available. Are there any questions on the bill itself?
Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 2880 be recommended passed to the Finance Committee.
Thank you. Do have someone, I guess, wants to speak?
What's come up?
Let the gentleman form. Have a seat and tell us who you are.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Kurt Laffinghouse. Apparently, I got to get close. I'm Kurt Laffinghouse. I am currently a guardian ad litem and a foster parent. My wife and I have been foster parents continuously since 1981 and have served over 110 children. And my wife was a guardian in the 90s for 6 years, and I'm currently active guardian ad litem. I don't claim to know everybody in the guardian ad litem community, but I think that generally we all agree that this is a useful and a good change, and we're enthusiastic about it. I want to second the comments that Ginny Rudloff made about the financing, and I think the someone should look closely into this language, which is kind of general, that there's funds out there in some of the districts that can be transferred, and then in the future, funds that are collected as fees can be used for these purposes. I think that's not been, it's certainly not made clear to me in anything that's published how that's, how much money is going to be acquired by that and whether that's going to serve the board as it's constituted. As to overview, there currently is in place a monthly, an organization of the managers of the various judicial districts' guardian program, who meet monthly with the state entity, and so there's plenty of communication on guardian ad litem matters through those professionals. So the only question I would have that I want to add to this and not take a lot more of your time is that the idea that people are highly qualified is not the same as people who are in place active guardians, either volunteer or professional, spaces for them on the board. It calls for highly qualified and is not the same as the Board of Architecture and the Board of Urban Design, who have actual practitioners, active practitioners joining this board and being involved in it in the oversight. So that's, I'm glad to answer any questions. I do want to say this. I want to thank you all for your continuing public service. I really appreciate it, and I expose people, rest of the people here. Some of them have said that in the past, but maybe not. I think we all appreciate what you're doing. So with that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. Senator Ingebrigtsen, do you have a question for that?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure, Mr.
Lapping.
Okay. So to gather from your testimony today that and thank you for your service, by the way. That many years is a lot of work, and actually I'm just thinking about getting into some of this myself, my wife and I, so kind of interested. But does it seem to you that the system is broke now and needs to be fixed?
I'm sorry, I didn't get your question.
I'm sorry. From your testimony, I gathered that there's nothing wrong with the system now. Is that right?
But I do think that this is an improvement, and especially if it moves toward more in-place guardian board membership, that would be a positive change.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and sir, you commented that this isn't like the architecture board and other boards where there are active architects, for example, who are on the board. But it looks like in the structure that's in the bill, with the way it's set up, that four people appointed by the governor, those could be people who are current guardians. Could it not?
Certainly could be, and the language is highly qualified. People are well versed in the guardian system.
So that would make sense that it would be.
Oh, it could be, absolutely. Why not just go straight ahead and say there shall be one or two active guardians or with so many years' experience? The people that are guardians, ma'am, I personally went through 6 weeks of training after I'd been a foster parent and well, highly involved in kids' care for that training. And when I said to the manager in the 4th District office, well, you've known me for 15 years, haven't you? I don't need to take all these classes. No, you have to take all the classes. And then you get one or two cases, and you are supervised closely by experienced former guardians or even current guardians before you're turned loose, more or less. So there's a big difference between being whatever highly qualified is and actually being an in-place experienced guardian.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments of this witness? Is there anyone else that wishes to speak?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Betzel, would you read?
Well, I renew my motion, Mr. Chair, that Senate File 2880 be recommended to pass.
You've heard that. Is there a
for a second engrossment.
All those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay.
Actually, I got a very
motion prevailed. Thank you, Senator Mo. Senate File 2634.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 2634 is the forfeiture bill. 2634 comes to this committee from the Judiciary Policy Committee. It is, we had a rather long hearing in the Policy Committee examining sort of three separate initiatives that were put forth. And after the hearing, Senate File 2634 sort of became the committee bill that tried to pull into this bill different elements of the three proposals that were taken up in the Judiciary Policy Committee. You all may recall that over the summer, as a result of the situation with the Metro Gang Strike Force, law enforcement forfeiture practices came under fire and raised some concerns. There has been a number of discussions on both sides. There is a proposal that is authored by Senator Latz, which is fairly aggressive and assertive in what it's trying to do. That's not this bill. The law enforcement community was concerned that Minnesota forfeiture laws were not broken and didn't need to be fixed. There are advocates who believe that even if it's not broken, this is a good opportunity to look at mending or just updating our forfeiture statutes. And so the different proposals that came before the policy committee were across the spectrum. This committee bill that comes to you is more of a middle-of-the-road pragmatic approach to forfeiture. It recognizes that the system as it currently is not necessarily broken. And yet there's also a recognition that as members of the legislation, as policymakers, we should use this as an opportunity to update some of the provisions of the forfeiture statutes. So that's the bill you have before you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Section, what I'd like to do is I'd like to briefly walk through the bill with you to just give you a context. And then I'd like to, with Mr. Turner's assistance, come back to the money pieces in the bill that is in this committee's jurisdiction. And I believe there's an A5 amendment to address the fiscal note that came that is in this committee. In essence, Mr. Chair, members, Section 1 to 5, 19, 20, and 16 of the bill just amends our current law to require more forfeiture reporting. Section 6 to 21 of the bill requires that the County Attorneys Association and the Post Board develop model policies on controlled substance forfeiture designed to promote the uniform applications of those laws across the state. Section 7 amends the conciliation court jurisdiction law to increase the monetary limit of claims that the court would hear to $15,000. This increase applies only to controlled substance forfeiture cases. Section 8 amends the statutory section addressing the purpose of forfeiture laws. It strikes the provision in that section that lists increasing the monetary loss resulting from the detection of criminal activity as a proper remedial purpose of the law. Section 9 amends the general forfeiture law to change statutory language from permissive to mandatory regarding a law enforcement officer's duty to secure seized property and prevent waste. Section 10 amends the general forfeiture law to allow owners of seized property to regain possession pending the forfeiture's outcome. Section 11 amends the general forfeiture law to authorize a person with an interest in seized property to file an application for an order to show cause to be issued to the prosecuting agency to determine if the probable cause existed to seize the property. Section 12 amends the controlled substance judicial forfeiture law. We basically increase the current monetary thresholds applicable to controlled substances involved in forfeiture. Section 14 amends the controlled substance administrative forfeiture law. We impose a cap of $15,000 for the value of property that may be administratively forfeited. We also increase we require that property having a higher value may be forfeited only through judicial forfeiture. Section 15 amends the law addressing the distribution of forfeiture proceeds, and this is one of the reasons why the bill is in this committee. Current law distributes the proceeds 70% to law enforcement agencies involved in the forfeiture, 20% to the prosecutorial agencies, and 10% to the general fund. Under the bill as proposed, we reduce the amount of 70% to law enforcement to 60%, 30% to prosecuting agencies, 5% to the general fund, and 5% to the Department of Public Safety for grants to local law enforcement agencies to purchase or replace squad camera car systems. The A5 amendment addresses this distribution, and so I will come back to this. Section 16 I talked about. Section 17 amends the law addressing the distribution of forfeiture proceeds. Section 18 amends the drive-by shooting forfeiture law to allow the same type of informal objection to an administrative forfeiture under the law. Section 22 requires the Commissioner of Public Safety and the Executive Director of the Post Board, in consultation with the Minnesota County Attorney Association, to develop the controlled substance administrative forfeiture notice language required in Section 14 above. And this language right now is very, very full of legalese, and we want to make it an everyday person language. Mr. Chair and members, that's the gist of the bill.
You got to do them.
The A5 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Members have that? Or?
No.
The A5 amendment, Mr. Chair and members, strikes the 30% of the distribution to the County Attorneys Association basically takes them back to status quo. It deletes the 5% to the general fund, and it inserts 15%. So the new distribution after the A5 amendment will be 60% to local law enforcement, 20% to county prosecutorial agencies, 5% to the Department of Public Safety for squad camera car operations and replacements, and 15% to the general fund, leaving, as I mentioned before, the 60% to the local law enforcement agencies. Mr. Chair and members, before I saw the fiscal note today, this morning, I was fully prepared to restore the distribution to the number as it was in current law. And I want to put that on the record because I had had a conversation with law enforcement, and once the county attorney said that they did not need the additional 10%, I was fully prepared to restore the 70% to local law enforcement. Unfortunately, in the A5 amendment, we couldn't do that because of the fiscal note to the general fund. And the reason why there was a cost to the general fund is when we went in and we in response to the county attorney's request to increase the amount to $15,000 where people can go to conciliation court, I believe that the number of people who would choose to go to conciliation court instead of filing their cases in district court has an impact on the general fund because of the decrease in the filing fees. The filing fee is less when you go to conciliation court instead of district court. And so because of that, we had to increase the distribution amount to the general fund in order to address the fiscal note. And so I wanted to put on the record that I fully intended to restore the 70% to law enforcement, but because of the impact on the general fund, I had to go with this distribution. And Mr. Chair, members, I hope that somebody will move the A5 amendment.
I will, Mr. Chair.
Chair Higgins has moved the A5 amendment. Discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. Motion prevails. She explained it all. Don't want to make any.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Ma did such a good job of explaining the amendment and the fiscal implications that I don't have much more to add. I will say that just in summary, however, there's two costs of the bill. The one is the loss of the court filing fees. That's in Section 13 of the bill. Under the court's assumptions, there's $188,000 per year loss. The second is the, and that's a loss to the general fund because the filing fees flow into the general fund. It's not a loss to the courts itself. And the second one is the general fund loss due to the change in the distribution of the forfeiture fees. The original bill lowered the general fund share from 10% to 5%. And the amendment restores, not only restores that 10%, but raises it to 15, which covers the loss in court filing fees as well. So we've actually, after, with the amendment, we actually have about a $45,000 cushion, general fund cushion, according to the assumptions of the fiscal note.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Turner? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Turner, is that $45,000 in the general fund, that cushion that you were just talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, yes.
Senator Limmer.
My question is not to Mr. Turner. General question.
Go ahead. Yeah, is there any
question?
Give me the question.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Mwam, in looking at the forfeiture notice that has been stricken from language, now this notice has to be written in English, Hmong, Somali, and Spanish, and the new language. There is no notice that we are prescribing in law. It simply says the notice must be worded in plain language and likely to be understandable to persons with limited reading skills, and I'm assuming in the language that's required. But the question I have is who would be creating the notice?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, in Section 22 of the bill, we ask that the Commissioner of Public Safety and the Executive Director of the Post Board in consultation with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association develop that language.
Madam Chair, as highly respect I have for county attorneys, but I'm wondering, do we have any other linguists that could make it in the prescribed plain as possible language as possible? And I don't know if it's, I don't want to besmirch a profession, but I guess I'm just looking, yeah, if they're attorneys, they write like attorneys. And I'm hoping we get to the goal that we are looking for. And then what happens, is there any consequence if they don't do it right? How do we correct that, or do we keep reviewing their work year after year?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, it's my hope that in the model policies that get developed, that language is being used uniformly all across the state, so that if there's a change in that uniform, in the language, that then it replaces all across the state. Looking at the language that we prescribe in statute, Senator Limmer, I almost think that anything would be better than that language that we currently have. So that in the Judiciary Policy Committee, we kind of struggled over this about, you know, who should do it, who should write it. At one point, I was tempted to name the two Lindas in Senator Limmer, you know. This was kind of the best, our best effort to try to come up with a group of people who we hope would be reflective of the everyday language that could be used.
Senator Hagan.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy being one of the Lindas to do that. My suggestion, though, is that it, when the language is finally done, that it not be put in all capital letters. All capital letters are hard to read, and it's hard to tell what's the important part. You know, you can use caps and lowercase and then use bold or italic or
bold italic,
which is caps. Gilding the lily. To emphasize phrases or sentences that are important, but when the whole thing is in all caps, it's just like, it's just a block. It isn't words. And so if we can, as we're going forward, that's just one more thing to think about in doing this.
All right, further questions. Senator Hagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ma, in my over the summer, I attended some of the meetings that you chaired, as well as Senator Higgins, with regards to the Metro Gang Drug Task Force issues and problems, and there's no question about it. There was some real wrongdoings there, and I understand now, and actually learned from you on the floor just maybe a week or two ago on another issue with regards to this, that they're still under investigation, those officers that were doing it wrong. So I'm somewhat familiar with what's going on. But during those hearings, we also had testimony from rural task forces throughout the state of Minnesota, where I think they were more than convincing that their programs out there, quite frankly, weren't broke, and that we were targeting, justifiably so, the areas that were broke, and that was down here in the Metro Gang Strike Force. Following up with that comment, I do have a couple questions about the bill. Some new language on page 6 would be .68. Property is not subject to forfeiture under the section should it put a hardship on the member of the owner's immediate family. Can you explain to me how someone's going to administer that? How are they going to determine that it's a hardship? Coming from that world, I'm not quite following how that would be done.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, it's a struggle. Part of the reason that I put this language in here is that we, in law, we have tried to provide for kind of an innocent owner defense, right? When you deal with people who are involved in these type of behaviors, it definitely is important and critical for us to go after the wrongdoer and the person who uses the car, the family car, who peddles the drugs. It is absolutely important to go after that behavior. But what this language is intended to do is that in the circumstances where you have a spouse or parent who has a family who needs the rent to be paid that month, and the perpetrator, as wrong as he is, may be selling drugs with the month's rent in cash in his pocket. And the family may be in a situation where if the rent doesn't get paid, they might be vulnerable to eviction. And so what this language as much as I'm trying to capture it, and as ineloquent as it is, it's put in there just sort of as a ticker to say, in these circumstances, we will give law enforcement and prosecutors an opportunity to say, in that circumstances, that's an innocent family that shouldn't be penalized or punished for the behavior of this individual who's peddling drugs with the family cash in his pocket or her pocket for that. So that's what this language is intended to do.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I understand the importance of punishing those that are doing wrong and not family members should they be victim to this. However, if the car was purchased or the equipment that's being seized was, well, I guess you can't really prove that it was purchased with drug money, unless the person has a job, somebody else has a job in that family. I mean, these are the types of things I think that law enforcement and prosecutors have to be able to prove. And that is going to be a problem because there are going to be some instances where nobody's working, but there seems to be a lot of money. And now we've found out why there's money is because the person is dealing drugs. And it just creates a real issue for law enforcement. There's no question about that. You can prove that if they haven't had a work history for the last 5 years and they're driving a nice car and living in a nice home and there's just no income coming in there, that was the threshold of being able to seize property, and I think that's just. My other question would be with regards to the percentages, and maybe I should have talked about this during the amendment, and I apologize if I should have done that, but nevertheless, it's part of the bill now, and that's the percentages broke down. And some of the dollars are going to be going towards in-car cameras, and they're going to have to apply to the Department of Public Safety. Is there not always, or hasn't there always been some kind of a program there? And frankly, I'm wondering what in-car camera systems would do for the drug operations. I know they can be taken out and utilized but it just kind of seems to be a little bit off track here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingerbritzen, during the conversations this past summer, you and I were, and all of us actually, were deeply concerned about the activities of the Metro Gang Strike Force, particularly in some of the saturation detail practices that resulted in some disproportionate impact on particular members of certain communities. And I think as a result of those conversations and that context, the Commission of Public Safety, to his credit, acted very quickly to say, listen, one of the things that we as law enforcement are willing to do in our practice is we're just going to use one-time federal dollars that we have that's at the department right now. We're going to equip every single cop car in the state of Minnesota. Not everyone had equipment because we do have money. We have a program a grant program that does that. But not every department had a vehicle equipped. So the Commission of Public Safety made that decision. That being said, that's one-time money to equip the cars with these cameras. There's ongoing replacement and operations to these cameras. And so as a result of that conversation, I thought that it is irresponsible for us to say to our local law enforcement agencies, we're going to equip your vehicles, but you gotta pay for the upkeep and the operations of these cameras. If the state doesn't have the money for you, then you have to pay for that yourself out of pocket. And so this was my way of being responsive to local law enforcement to say, if we're going to do that and equip all of your vehicles with this, then we want to set aside a fund to help you deal with the upkeep and the replacement of it.
We do have some folks here from public safety that may be better positioned to answer the questions that you.
I think I can just follow up with a comment. I'm very familiar with that, and I commend the commissioner for doing that. I don't think law enforcement's ever stood in the way of wanting to be up front, at least that I've ever seen. Other than now, we've come obviously to a group of potential wrongdoers here. That are not doing it right, and I was just wondering why the correlation was there, because I knew there was some funding out there. My other question and this you can answer, is the 60% that goes to law enforcement, does it go directly to law enforcement or go into their general fund? Is that your intention?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm wondering maybe Ms. Backus can refer me to the bill. We looked at a number of different, I think in this version of the bill, it goes directly to law enforcement, right, Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair and members, if you look on page 9, beginning on line 21, the only change is the percentage of the money going to law enforcement. There's no change to where the money's actually going. I mean, you know, it doesn't go into a separate fund or anything like that.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, some of the other proposals have it going to different pots, but not in this bill.
Yeah, just thank you for that. Yeah, that must have been a different one I was thinking of then, because I knew that was happening. And I certainly, again, understand that the perception out there is that law enforcement has to go out and make these unjust, non-legal arrests out there to be able to keep their head above water. And I don't like to hear that. Obviously, nobody in this room likes to hear that. That is talked about. That was talked about this summer. And moving forward, I'm certainly concerned about the cut there. I just hope that's not a punitive thing for the rest of the state task forces that are operating properly out there. And you know my concern about that. I've voiced it several times. So, thanks.
Mr. Chair and members, just for the record, that's absolutely not the intent of this. And, you know, I testified earlier on the record when I asked for the A5 amendment to be put on that I was intended to fully restore that amount, but for the fiscal note and its impact and trying to make the general fund whole. So.
Further questions? Chair Mao? Is there... Anybody that's in the audience that wants to speak to this legislation? Sorry.
Mr. Chair, seeing no one going to the table, I'll move that Senate file, 2634, as amended, be recommended to pass. It goes to big finance.
You've heard the discussion. Is there anyone... want any further comment before we move? Seeing none, all those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We now have reached Senate File 2741. Senator Murphy. Sarah Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity to bring this bill in front of your committee. Many of you have probably been on a committee or two where this bill has already been discussed, but the reason why we're here today is that the bill does have a fiscal impact, and I believe that you all have that fiscal note in your packets. And it does show that there is some cost to the court system. I believe that Senator Ingebrigtsen has an amendment that would take the fiscal implications out. I know that there's folks here that want to speak in opposition to the amendment that I've asked Senator Ingebrigtsen to bring forward. But members, the bottom line is that DWI enforcement in our state is a tough thing to do. We all know that. And it affects different families in different ways. So what we're trying to do here is to build a program so that full driving privileges are restored to the offender if they decide to put the interlock system in their car. Now, in Senator Moore's committee, we changed the bill slightly so that on your first offense, the DWI interlock is if you're between 0.08 and 0.14, it's not going to be mandatory. It's going to be an option. But if those people who have the lower blood alcohol limit decide to go on the interlock program, they can get the interlock put in their car, and they can resume full driving privileges, which is completely different than what we do today. Today, people get put on work permits or B cards or some other type of restricted driver's license, which does not allow them the freedom to pick their kids up at school or go to their doctor's appointment. They can only go back and forth to work, period. And there's still that delay time in today's law where people, they're mandated to either walk or get a ride to wherever they're going. This, if you put the DWI, if you put the interlock system in your car, you get full driving privileges right away. So there's that option for first-time offenders in the lower blood alcohol. Once you go to 0.15 or higher with your blood alcohol content, it's mandatory. You have to put this in if you want any driving privileges at all. This helps not only the public, and I'll talk about that in a second, but it also helps those families who have someone who has broken the law, chose to drink and drive, and that's a choice. Now we are saying that if you want your full driving privileges, it's not a choice. You have to put this in. And that's where the public benefit comes in. We know that if you put the interlock system in your car, and it's used the way that it's specified in law, that we're going to have sober drivers on the road. And that's what everybody wants. People are tired of picking up the paper day in and day out and reading that a drunk driver killed a family of four or killed the breadwinner of a family or whatever it might be. We're all tired of hearing that. This is going to help put more sober drivers on the road. We're going to take people who chose not to obey the law, and we're going to turn them into law-abiding citizens. Now, for those people who choose who have had the DWI and choose to operate outside of the parameters of this bill, the penalties are even stiffer for those folks. What we want are we want compliant drivers who are sober, and I really believe that this bill is going to go a long way in making that happen, Mr. Chairman, members, and. The amendment that I've asked Senator Ingebrigtsen to look at is a result of some action that was taken in Senator Moore's committee. There was a lot of action taken in Senator Moore's committee, and I feel that a lot of it, like the first-time DWI offender, I think that is a prudent move. This separation of the enhancement, which this addresses, the more that I've come to learn about that, the more that I feel that what we do today since 2001 is appropriate. It allows an enhancement on a second DWI in conjunction with that first administrative action. And that's what we've been doing since 2001. That seems to work. And in Senator Moore's committee, and Senator Moore, correct me if I'm wrong, but we changed that so that the enhancement doesn't occur. And it's going to make the administration of this bill a little more difficult if we don't have that mechanism in place. And, Mr. Chairman, that's unless you want to go into more detail of what the bill does and does not do. I believe that's the issue in front of your committee is the cost of the fiscal note. And members, when the fiscal note was written, this is a tough fiscal note to write. And I think Mr. Turner can talk to it better than I can. But the courts, I believe, did as best as they could to put together a fiscal note that reflects what they feel could happen. and it was a $250,000 expense. And like I said, Mr. Turner can probably speak to that enhancement portion better than I can, or at least a fiscal note.
Concern I have, of course, is that if we offer that amendment and it's passed, why, I would say that that essentially reduced the need of having a fiscal note on that, and would expect that the matter would go back to the full Finance Committee and send it out or to the floor, I guess.
Well, Mr. Chairman, your portion of your committee is like the finance portion of my committee, and everything that comes down that deals with money has to go back to full finance. Mm-hmm. So this bill will have to go back to full finance.
But so far as the what you describe may not be a responsibility of this committee, and that's the question as I see it is are you looking at the A5 amendment?
The A5 amendment, I'd like to.
I'm not.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
At Senator Cohen, you might have. Take it, move it from there. Senator Ingebrigtsen, go ahead.
I would like to move the A5 amendment.
Do you have a motion, a discussion on the motion?
Well, Mr. Chair, the bill that we have before us does have a significant cost to the courts. And, I don't know that it would be responsible for us to send forward a bill to the Finance Committee unless we know how we're going to propose to deal with it.
Mr. Turner, maybe I have responded to that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, and members, the bill has actually three agencies that respond to the fiscal note responded. In Article 1, the Department of Public Safety responded because they are the agency that will administer the Ignition Interlock Program. That portion of the fiscal note concerns it has no state general fund impact. It notes a $73,000 first year cost and a $67,000 subsequent year cost. But the Office of Traffic Safety and the Department of Public Safety proposes to use the federal safety Section 164 grant to hire a person to administer the Ignition Interlock Program. The other two cost drivers in the bill are in Article 2. One is to the courts, and one is to the Department of Corrections. And if Article 2 is adopted, they would no longer exist, but I'll go over them really quickly. The cost of the courts of $259,000 comes from these assumptions. You figure under the bill, there would be more defendants would go to trial to avoid a criminal conviction, since that would be the only enhancer left now that a driver's license revocation would not be, an alcohol-related driver's license revocation would not be an enhancer. So there'd be more defendants that would go to trial to avoid a criminal conviction. According to the court's numbers, there's 51,000 DWI cases per year. 1% would go to trial, approximately 500 new trials at $10 jury per diem, $10 per diem and 27 cents per mile. And their calculation is $259,000 in increased jury costs. That does not increase any cost to court infrastructure, judicial units, et cetera. It's pure jury costs. There's a few other things that were considered. There would be a penalty for tampering with the interlock system. It was determined that would be fairly small. They said between five and, I think, five cases per year, minimal impact on the court.
Any good times?
I think another factor was that driving after revocation caseload would probably drop. There was no savings involved in that. It was mentioned in the note, it's not as onerous a charge as DWI. Wouldn't be as many jury trials. That was not factored in. Like I said, no judicial calendar increases were factored in, jury reimbursement only. And finally, just to note, there were no public defender costs factored in, and there were no attorney general costs or attorney general savings factored in, and the attorney general handles implied consent challenges. So the only court costs are the $259,000, and those are jury costs only. And finally, the DOC, the Department of Corrections, calculates that there would be some savings because there would be fewer offenders each year sentenced for felony DWI because the driver's license revocation would not be enhance a criminal DWI conviction. And they calculated 206 fewer offenders each year. That comes out to the first year, roughly 11 prison beds, 34 prison beds, 56 prison beds. It would eventually peak in the year 2015 at a bed savings of $1.5 million per year. So those are the three costs in the bill, costs or savings. It's a small staff cost to the DPS, which is federal funds. That's Article 1. In Article 2, you got a court cost of $259,000 and then a DOC savings. And if Article 2 is passed, if the amendment is passed, Article 2 is deleted, and you're left with just implementing the interlock, ignition interlock program.
Thank you. Questions of this witness? Senator Ingebridge.
No, I don't have any questions. I just have a comment with regards to, and I think Senator Murphy's probably going to support this, that if we're going to be serious about this, let's be serious. And I know there are those that are going to play this right to the very end. And if we're going to be serious about taking these folks off the road, then I think we have to be, you know, following through with this all the way through, and instead of overlooking the first infraction, should it be something slight, minor in the minds of a few. Didn't sound to me like, to me, too much of a physical impact here, unless I'm reading it wrong. Just a comment.
Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, have we heard from the court yet?
This is the first stop.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you heard Mr. Turner describe how the fiscal note, the assumptions made for the fiscal note, I think that you could look at that, as a two-sided coin. I mean, it could cost substantially more, or it could be less, because some of the assumptions that are made, 1% of the cases going back to jury trial, that could be 3%, or it could be 5%, or, it could be zero. The costs that weren't figured in, whether it was the cost to the courts, the judge time, the court reporter, all of that, mm-hmm. not figured in. Tough to figure it in when you don't know if it's, 1% or 5% or whatever it might be. So I can understand why there's some ambiguity with the fiscal note. I really understand that, but if we're going to make sure that it has zero cost to the courts, then we need to remove Article 2. And I know that, I know Senator Moaz here, and she would more than likely speak against that amendment. But Mr. Chairman, I like the amendment,
yeah.
But I think there's others in the room that may not.
Did the commissioner indicate a need to speak on this? Well, that's much help. How about the court branch? Does anyone from the court branch here as wishes to
discussed.
Speak to this?
All right, so this was.
Mr. Chair, I agree that the amendment is the issue at stake here.
Come to the mic.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sean McCarthy.
All right. Proceed. Tell us what you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you, Senator. A little background to let you know kind of where my comments come from. I was an assistant attorney general for 10 years doing implied consents. I worked for the Public Safety Division representing the State Patrol, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, a number of other boards and entities there. 85-90% of what I did was DWI, implied consent cases. For the last 3 years and currently, I'm a prosecutor, criminal prosecutor for the cities of Rosemont and Hastings. I get the unique chance because of my past job and my current job to see how both ends of the DWI come out in terms of the civil implied consent and the criminal DWI. With regard to Article 2, the portion of the bill that would eliminate enhancement of DWI criminal charges based upon civil implied consent license revocations, I and other prosecutors throughout the state strongly oppose that portion. In fact, we would support, I believe it's what you've referred to as the A5 amendment that would delete that. The reasons for that opposal are as follows. Enhancement of DWIs based on implied consent revocations protects public safety in the following ways. First, it allows courts to accurately count all impaired driving incidents. Somebody comes in front of a judge and they're facing consequences for a DWI. You should be able to count every time they've been driving while impaired and all those driving while impaired cases where they got stopped and arrested and ended up in the court process, there's a fair percentage of those that there may not be a criminal DWI conviction. In fact, we've been doing this since 1992. We've got 18 years of plea agreements in which some percentage of those pleas on a DWI case resulted in a non-DWI plea, somebody who got a careless driving or a reckless driving, some kind of a non-DWI disposition. The reason they got that is because prosecutors have been relying on the fact that the implied consent license revocation that remains on the person's record as a part of that plea agreement, that revocation can be used for enhancement. Article 2 would completely undo that and make a step backwards 18 years in time. In terms of the fiscal note, the specific item that was being discussed, another reason that the DWI enhancement protects public safety here is it allows the court, when they're accurately counting up, somebody who's really on their second DWI, but the first time they got a careless, first timer, no jail. Second timer, mandatory, 30 days confinement, 2 days in jail, 28 days electronic home monitoring bracelet. You're removing, in Article 2, the ability of a judge to court order, because of the mandatory minimums in the statute, court order both the punishment and it's cutting back on the ability of the court to some degree to court order treatment requirements as well. Supervised probation for 2 years versus 1 year for the person who's truly a second-time offender. Another example of fiscal impact here is there's a huge incentive for the person who's got multiple DWIs, the repeat DWI offender. The person who suddenly gets to, right now they've got three and they're facing their next DWI as a felony, that's four within 10 years. If their first or second one happened to have been only an implied consent revocation without a DWI conviction because they negotiated a careless in exchange for leaving the implied consent on the record or they lost the implied consent and that's why the prosecutor gave them a careless driving, in those contexts, that person suddenly gets a huge windfall. Instead of facing a felony, now they're only facing a gross. Some other fiscal information that wasn't, I don't think, in the timing here, it looks like it just simply didn't get a chance to get addressed in the fiscal note, be a huge impact on the public defenders. Every single person facing a DWI would have an incentive, the way Article 2 is currently drafted, to challenge the case, to have a contested hearing requiring police officers to show up and get paid overtime, to have a jury trial, again, requiring police officers to show up, also requires the city attorneys and local government to have additional burden. My office is on contract with the city of Hastings and city of Rosemont, and every time I'm going to court, that's money out of their budgets. The impact on local and fiscal local government here in terms of the prosecution costs, not addressed in the fiscal note. The public defenders, again, same kind of situation. Every client facing a DWI charge, who if they beat the DWI by going to a jury trial and getting the jury to nullify it or some kind of twist that happens along the way, that's cost to the public defender and having to go through that process. There's an argument that has been suggested that there'll be money saved by fewer implied consent challenges. The problem with that is only about 1 in 8 people challenge an implied consent to begin with. Very few of them actually prevail. And right now, there's a lot of incentive because the defense attorney representing somebody facing an implied consent revocation would still need to fight the implied consent to be able to beat the revocation, to get the person their license back more quickly. So incentive there to challenge that. So there's no savings in terms of reduced number of implied consents. Plus, there are a huge number of implied consent DWI defense attorneys, people that challenge the implied consent routinely as part of their marketing and part of their business practice. They use the implied consent. That's a free chance to see. Number one, do the officers show up? Number two, if they do show up, hey, let's see how they testify. Let's see how my client testifies. Through that process, they educate the client. They get a quick and speedy hearing in court. That's only a short hearing. It's a court trial, judge only. Handling implied consents in Dakota County during my time period, it was not uncommon for us to have 15 or 20 implied consents scheduled on a Friday morning. Typically, we were done by noon or 1 o'clock on the tail end. There might be, you know, occasional case that drags out longer than that, but the vast majority of those cases, it was show up, count the noses. If everybody's there, we're going to waive that hearing. And now that I've had my client here in court, they feel like they've had an opportunity to kind of see how the process works. We're going to go plea them guilty on the DWI now. But part of the DWI plea is counting on that implied consent being on the driving record for enhancement purposes. Another point here that's not, I think, well developed is the statistically, pre-enhancement, before we used implied consents to enhance, just as many, just as high a percentage of implied consent cases were challenged before that as were after. There was a little bump when the law was brand new, but it smoothed out, lo and behold. It's my understanding that there are no statistically significant differences in the number of challenges. So any perceived savings by eliminating implied consents as an enhancer really aren't savings, because how do you get savings if they weren't any fewer before we made that enhanceability part of the law, and then after it's part of the law, we haven't seen any increase. It doesn't make any money savings overall. Lastly, the number of appearances in court is a piece that's kind of missing, I would suggest, from the court's fiscal note. It seems like the only monies that the court fiscal note is based on is cost of bringing in jurors and their mileage. But you're ignoring the fact is, or what's ignored as part of that process is that in a criminal case, you typically have a first appearance, pre-trial. You may have an omnibus hearing. You have a contested omnibus hearing or some kind of contested evidentiary hearing. Some counties and jurisdictions also have a settlement conference and then a jury trial. There's 6 or 7, again, depending on which county you're in. You could have 5, 6, maybe 7 different court appearances on the criminal side. That's using up court staff, judge time, courtroom time. On the implied consent, typically the vast majority of civil implied consent hearings are resolved at the first or at most the second appearance. There are a small percentage, there are certain practitioners who drag it out as long as they can and keep cases bumped around, but the reality here, and this is the part that I think is important for the committee to try to understand as best it can, and I'll offer my vantage point to do that. The reality is that most implied consent cases dictate what happens on the criminal DWI. If there's an implied consent challenge and I, as a prosecutor, find out because the defense attorney gives me an order. Trial judge threw the case out, said it was a bad traffic stop. Am I going to waste time with multiple criminal settings and have an omnibus and a contested omnibus and a jury trial where I already have a judge who's reviewed the same facts and the same testimony? The only time my office or other prosecutors I'm aware of will even do that is if there was some missing witness that maybe was part, there's more facts that should have been there. Mm-hmm. But in reality, if most of the implied consents are done at the first and second appearance, and the result of the implied consent really has a big impact on what plea agreement the parties reach in the criminal case, eliminating the implied consent as an enhancer undercuts that whole process, because now suddenly there's an incentive to not just at the original first appearance or pretrial, see what the status of the implied consent is and resolve the criminal case and done with everything. Instead, there's an incentive to let's challenge this at every stage of the proceeding. The only two real beneficiaries of Article 2 are the repeat drunk driver, who the longer they stall it out, the longer they avoid the consequences and avoid having court-ordered treatment, the longer they have court-ordered sanctions pushed off. And number two, the criminal defense bar, the private criminal defense attorney, who suddenly, if you can't use implied consents to enhance, they got a lot more leverage and a lot more flexibility in terms of drawing in prospective clients and a lot more room to, for some clients, it might be, gee, can you just delay this a couple of years until I, you know, get some more money or get things in order? That's one option. Or, yeah, maybe I want it resolved kind of quickly, but, gee, can you cut a deal so it doesn't go down as a conviction and I don't get enhanced on a future one because I do want to keep drinking? You know, changing people's drinking habits is incredibly hard. For some people, all it takes is, for a matter of fact, the vast majority, 80% of DWI offenders get one and never come back. That's a good thing. But that remainder, that 20% who get more DWIs over time, getting those folks to change their drinking habits is incredibly difficult. Removing implied consents as an enhancer undermines the court's ability to use the court's power, the court's order ability. They can order somebody to go to treatment. They can order somebody to go to jail if they don't go to treatment. They can order somebody to comply with mandatory testing, all the different things that courts have the power to do. In light of that, the position that I, on behalf of the various prosecutors throughout the state, would try to advance here is that ignition interlock seems like a pretty good idea. There's some merit there. But Article 2 should be deleted from that because there's an enormous fiscal impact. It's shifting the forum. Right now, where a lot of those cases are resolved quickly and informally, 15 or 20 on a Friday morning get resolved on the implied consent, they're not going to spill over into, oh, let's do a few one-day jury trials. That's an increase in cost there. But in reality, I've never had a one-day DWI jury trial. And I know the other prosecutors that are here today that I've checked with, likewise, one-day jury trials aren't a reality for most of our schedules and most of the way our court calendars work in the DWI context, because DWI cases tend to be some of the most resource-intensive and the most time-consuming cases, partially because in Minnesota, we have a specialized DWI defense bar. People who do 85, 95% of their practice is DWI cases. In light of that, the most compelling reason here is there's no rationale why Article 2 should be included and why we should eliminate implied consent license revocations. Why should Minnesota stop using this legitimate tool to protect the public? Will it save time? No. It won't save court time, and it won't save the state any time. Will it save the state or the courts money? No. Will it save the state lives? No. I would argue that, if anything, it's going to let some repeat offenders get back on the road without facing consequences that the court could have imposed upon them. It actually creates a loophole for those repeat offenders. Here's a classic example. There's a case from 2009 at the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
It's over helping.
In Omwega, Omwega. Gentleman got a felony DWI because he had three implied consent license revocations. Those were the three priors that counted to get him up to a felony. If the law as proposed, including Article 2, were the law, then that gentleman would not have been facing a felony. He would have been facing a misdemeanor. In light of that, that's the strongest example here. The arguments that it's not fair, it's just not, it's too hard on DWI offenders, those arguments have been made for the last 18 years, and they've been rejected by our courts. There are no less than six appellate decisions saying that enhancement based on implied consent revocations is, in fact, allowable, fair, and it satisfies constitutional due process.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks. Sarah Mao, perhaps you would like to respond to what you just
Mr.
said.
Mr. Chairman, members, as eloquent as the witnesses, the Judiciary Policy Committee didn't just thoughtlessly put this language in the bill. I think it was crafted with much conversation among the different stakeholders. and in the recognition that it takes two bodies in executive branch action to enact anything into law. And I believe that if this provision was crafted to stake out a Senate position on implied consent, and I think that if you strip this out of the bill, I think that I don't know what's going to happen in the other body with respect to implied consent, but there certainly have been proposals to do away with implied consent totally. And so this was an attempt to try to craft a compromise to not totally do away with implied consent, recognize it for its value, but to address the enhancement factor. So it's a half step for the people who wish to do away with implied consent totally. And so the, as eloquent as the witness is, I think that the language that's in this bill in Section 2 was really an attempt to craft a compromise among people who really wanted to do away with implied consent to say there's some value to the implied consent process, but perhaps what you object to is not necessarily the value of the implied consent process. Perhaps if we did away with the enhancement, that will allow us to be able to live with the implied consent process and, in fact, keep it in place and protect it. So that was my intent, not necessarily all the things that the witness spoke to. And I believe Mr. Sheridan is here, and if you've got the time, he can speak. If not, that's, it's up to you, Mr. Chair.
Briefly, I certainly don't want to take any opportunity to present anything, so a couple of minutes would be in order. If you had.
Well, just so we're clear, I'm not Mr. Sheridan.
Well, let's get him up.
I don't think he wants me to claim I'm Mr. Sheridan. I was on the agenda to speak. I'll yield to Mr. Sheridan. I'm from Mothers Against Drunk Driving, so if he wants to speak first, then I can speak after, whatever the chair prefers.
Would you please state your name?
Yes, my name is Jeffrey Sheridan. I am probably one of the people that Mr. McCarthy was speaking of earlier. I am an attorney in private practice. I focus my practice primarily on DWI defense work. Let me note at the outset there was a suggestion that somehow the defense bar would profit from this bill. I can assure you I get emails every day wondering why I'm down here speaking in favor of this bill. Frankly, from the perspective of the DWI defense bar, the more serious, the more consequences, the better we like it, because we get to charge more money, and these severe consequences drive more clients into our loving arms. So I can assure you that the defense bar is not overly pleased with me being here testifying on behalf of this particular amendment. The reason I do appear here to testify on behalf, or I'm sorry, in opposition to A5 and in favor of Article 2 is what I've spoken with Senator Mawa about over the course of our relationship, and that is a question of fundamental fairness. As our implied consent law exists today, having a police officer issue a notice and order of license revocation on the street at the time of the arrest because it was the officer's opinion that the driver had broken one of his promises to the state. Those implied promises are that you won't operate with an alcohol concentration above the prohibited level, and that you, if you're lawfully requested to do so by a police officer, that you will provide a sample of your blood, breath, or urine. The way the law works today is that if a peace officer arrives at the conclusion that is in his opinion you have broken one of those promises, then that police officer has the authority on the spot to issue you a notice and order of license revocation. That revocation is then noted on your record as the implied consent revocation that we're speaking of here today. The implied consent law also contains the shortest statute of limitations in Minnesota law, 30 days. You have 30 days to challenge that action taken by the police officer and in his sole discretion. You have 30 days to say, hey, wait a minute, I don't want the police officer to be the one to decide whether this blemish is permanently a part of my record. I would like to have a referee in this game. I would like to have a judge decide this. And you do that by filing a civil lawsuit against the Department of Public Safety within 30 days. If you fail to do so within 30 days, that blemish is a permanent part of the record. And as the law is implemented today, roughly 84% of all license revocations appear on a person's driving record simply by the passing of 31 days, without a review by a police supervisor, without a review by the Department of Public Safety, without a review by a court. A person's license revocation becomes a permanent part of their record on the 31st day after the officer issues that revocation. Now, the other thing that happens is they are prosecuted. They're prosecuted in the criminal process of the United States of America as we understand that process to exist, including being cloaked in the presumption of innocence, the right to trial by jury, the right to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And when the person goes through that process, it may well be that during the course of that process, the person is found not guilty, or that the state chooses not to prosecute at all, none of which matters, because simply by the passing of 31 days, the person already has a blemish on their record that says their license was revoked at the hands of a police officer. We treat those two things, a verdict of a jury in a criminal trial and the passing of 31 days, as the virtually identically. There is no distinction drawn between those two acts. Even if the person challenges the revocation within those 30 days, they are entitled to a hearing, but it's a civil trial, and as Mr. McCarthy described it, a civil trial to a judge sitting alone, where the burden of proof is proof by a preponderance of the evidence. So in order for the state to prevail in the implied consent hearing, all they have to do is establish that it's more likely than not that the person broke one of their promises to the state by either operating with a prohibited alcohol level or by refusing to take the test. That is the situation as it exists today and as it has existed since 2001 when the law was completely revamped. It is that system that, as I understand Senator Mua's motivations, is to stop doing that, to stop treating those two very different things as though they are the same, to say that the passing of 31 days is just as rock solid as a criminal conviction is simply not consistent with our concept of criminal justice in this country. That's the first motivation, as I understand it. The second motivation is the overwhelming disproportionate effect that this law has on the poor. Remember that a person has to challenge their license revocation within 30 days. It is an extremely complicated process. I have made a 25-year career out of that particular process. It is not easy to do. It is not cheap to do. And so by the time a person who is of modest means makes their first court appearance, oftentimes if they're going to ask for the services of a public defender, the first thing the public defender has to tell them is, well, because this happened more than 31 days ago, I'm sorry, the amount of help I will be able to provide you is minimal. Even if the public defender is able to take that person through the jury trial and win it, have the jury come back and find the person not guilty, it doesn't matter. The police officer has already decided he was guilty, and that blemish will stay with the person for the rest of their lives. This disproportionately affects people of modest means. I'm not free. I'm not even close to it. And it is extremely difficult for people to make this challenge without the assistance of competent counsel. The third thing is the issue of these costs, and the reason I came here today was to testify with regard to the fiscal note that I saw that came through with regard to this. This law existed prior to 2001, that these two things were completely separate. They did not count the same. And yet, when they did the fiscal note, they didn't bother to go back to the era when we didn't treat the revocation as a conviction and say, well, did fewer people go to trial after we changed that law? How do they assume that more people will go to trial if we repeal the law if they didn't look to see whether fewer people went to trial when the law first went into effect? That's one of the objections I have to this, is that it is a wildly speculative assumption that 1% more people will go to trial each year. I don't believe there's any basis in truth for that, just based on my personal experience and what I've seen over the 25 years that I've done this. But more importantly, what I do know has happened is that the number of implied consent challenges has gone up dramatically. When I first started doing this, there were perhaps 8 to 9% of all the people whose licenses were revoked who would end up challenging that revocation. It's now 17%. That's a doubling of the number of challenges that are taking place under, because the stakes associated with the revocation are now so high. So if we were to reduce the stakes again, there's no reason to assume that the number of challenges wouldn't go down to the same level they were at before the legislature increased the stakes associated with the revocation. So with that in mind, I do think that there is a large part of the fiscal note that's missing, and that is the cost savings associated with lowering the stakes associated with that revocation.
Thank you. I'm sure there's a number, certainly in this committee, that have worked for the Attorney General or some other person and has experienced some of the things that you and your predecessor up there spoke. I know a common thing is an individual has a plea of not guilty, and then when everybody shows up and the BCA agent is driven in from St. Paul to Thief River Falls, why at that point, why they will switch and plead guilty, and so you just wasted the time of the experts and so forth. But be that as it may, in this matter that we have here, I see your direction that you're taking. I saw the same thing earlier, and the question is, what can we do really to make this a workable thing that will be able to deal with that, so that we have a justice system, and it's one that's not plagued with the poor, as you see. I know, having spent 33 years as a police officer, that the Schwinn ticket that we used to give to the individual when we took his license, why that was a common thing. So clearly, if you're rich, you can afford that. $10,000 or $15,000. If you're not rich and maybe not able to read too good, or a foreign national of some sort, you got a serious problem.
Mr. Chairman, to this point about fundamental fairness and fairness to the poor, now I would agree that with Mr. Sheridan that there are parts of the fiscal note, and I think I said that earlier, that they're tough to hang numbers on. We all understand that. It's just the nature of this beast that we've got in front of us. But, Mr. Chairman, those are public roads. The vast majority of people choose to abide by the law and drive sober. Those who choose to get drunk and drive on the roads, in my opinion, they should be revoked permanently, like they do in some other countries. This is a path that is fairer for those folks. And if you're poor and you're out drinking and driving, maybe you should rectify the drinking part, because if you're poor, how can you afford alcohol? That's what I'm here to say. If you're poor and you're an alcoholic, we have systems in place to help you. But if you're poor, you're an alcoholic, and you choose to get in your car and drive, then you are imposing upon my civil rights, Senator Ingebrigtsen's civil rights, and everybody else in this room who chooses to drive sober and safe. You're infringing upon us. I have no sympathy at all. They need to change their personal behavior.
I understand what you're saying, and you're entitled to that opinion. But,
well, Mr. Chairman, yes, that is my opinion, and maybe I'm a little too hard-nosed on that, but, you know, I just went past 20 years of sobriety on March 23rd of this year, and only by the grace of God did I not kill anybody. Only by the grace of God did I not get a DWI, or like I said, even worse, kill somebody. Mr. Chairman, alcoholism is a terrible, terrible disease. And for those people who choose to get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 100 DWIs, they have chosen to live the life of that behavior. There is no way that we need in this committee or in this legislature to say that that is okay. They need to change their personal behavior. There is a thing called personal responsibility still in this world. And, you know, as an alcoholic, I can tell you it's tough to change your behavior, but it can be done. And people need to accept that personal responsibility. That's what this is about. Mr. Chairman, this is a fair program. For those people who choose to change their behavior, they're going to get full driving privileges back. They can take their kids to school. They can go to the doctor's appointments. They can go to the grocery store. They can go visit their grandparents. But if they choose not to change their behavior, we're not going to let them back on the road, and nor should we, because they're going to end up killing somebody.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman?
1 minute.
For me?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, let me make very clear my position that Article 1 of this bill is a good bill, and I would urge this body to advance it to a full vote. I am not suggesting for a moment that the Interlock program is a bad program. I support it, and I know very few people who do not support it. My position is merely the Article 2 portion of this, and that is it's something that should be debated, that if we're going to treat a civil license revocation as the equivalent of a DWI conviction, then somebody ought to be able to step forward and say why those two things should be treated the same. That's all I'm saying. I think Senator Mua has arrived at the conclusion that they shouldn't be treated as the same. And while I've heard prosecutors talk about how they don't want to lose this tool, I've not heard a single prosecutor articulate why the passing of 31 days should count the same as a jury's verdict. And perhaps if somebody can articulate that to me, maybe I'll be persuaded to change my view. But that's all my position is that we shouldn't treat civil revocations the same as criminal convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could be heard, I want to speak today on behalf of victims of drunk driving. Good afternoon. I'll be brief, sir, I promise.
Tell us your name, please.
My name is David Palm. I'm on the board for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I'm also an attorney. But I want to speak on a personal level on behalf of the Mothers Against Drunk Driving victims that we serve. Now, sir, we are in support of Ignition Interlock. We supported that. We've advocated for that for many years. The problem here is that we've attached a piece to this bill that is not going to allow us to hold drunk drivers accountable. Sir, this is about driving being a privilege. When a person gets behind that car and kills one of the family members that we serve, they lose that privilege, and they should not get their license back. And that revocation should be on that record, and the prosecutors here in this room that I serve with as my colleagues should be able to use that to enhance and hold these people accountable. Sir, what we're asking you to do today is to do supporting Ignition Interlock and do that. That's a tool. It's another tool in the toolbox that will allow us to keep drunk drivers off the road. But to attach this amendment to it, to take away a tool that allows us to enhance crimes, to hold drunk drivers accountable, will be defeating the purpose, sir. And so I'm asking you, I'm pleading with you to please remove this part of the amendment. Do it for the families out there. Do it for my daughter, my unborn daughter, to keep them safe. prosecutors have to hold DWI offenders accountable. We can do that with license revocations and with this bill, and I ask you to please do that. Thank you. Thank you.
Sarah Higgins, you indicated before someone.
Oh, I did. Had a thought. And I think I figured it out, and so I'll just pass.
All right. Senator Higgins.
Just one more comment. And I think we have to move along here. I think we certainly have had enough testimony, but I really have to applaud Senator Murphy for his eloquent way of describing what kind of personal responsibilities we as people in the state of Minnesota have when we get in behind the wheel of the car. And I can't imagine anybody, rich or poor, knowing anything other than the fact that if they drink and drive, they are going to be in trouble. I mean, at the very least, they're going to be in trouble. And they've got 31 days. I think the form is given to that officer who we've now enlisted to go out there and actually do this enforcement function. They have 31 days to respond to this. And I know he talked about that there's going to be 17 more, or 17% since the stakes are higher, the 17% more contested implied consent cases. But I would almost guess, and I'm not going to ask because I think we might get into a longer process than we probably thought we were going to be into, as to how many of those are actually found not guilty. I don't think there's hardly any. So the law does work. Let's continue to use the law. Let's protect those out there that expect us to do that and demand that of our drivers, and let's get serious about this. And I'd like to reoffer my amendment, if I could, to move it along.
I want to give the author a quick shot there. Sarah Mao, would you want to have a closing remark?
Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Chair, thank you. I know that's unusual for another member of the committee who doesn't sit on the committee to be here. I think that the policy committee had this very discussion for quite lengthy discussion on the policy piece of it. And the policy committee made the decision that as a matter of public policy, it was important for us to move this bill forward with the recommendation that we undo the enhancement factor. The only piece that's before this committee, of course, is the fact that there is a speculative fiscal note on this bill and on this portion. My only thought is that, this bill is on its way to full committee. While the fiscal note to the court is of concern, and it concerns me too, we net positive in the general fund because of the impact on corrections. And so my thinking on this is that I'd like to have the committee consider keeping the bill intact and send it to full committee and have and maybe send it without a recommendation because of the concern on the courts, but have the full finance committee have an opportunity to look at this with all the multiple budgets that are implicated, because this bill does net positive for the general fund. That being said, I also want to make sure I put on the record that this language to decouple the enhancement is not hostile to the bill. And in fact, I'm a co-author on this bill. I fully support this bill. It's my attempt to try to craft a compromise to create a preemptory strike against the other body who are maybe moving in a direction where they're going to totally come to a conference if it makes out a committee to do away totally with implied consent. And so I just think that it would be smart for us to be thoughtful about where we would like to land in terms of our negotiations with them. So there are, strategic decisions involved in why the policy committee moved forward in this direction. And I fully respect MAD and the work that they've done. I respect, Senator Murphy's experiences. I fully am in support of this bill. This language is just an attempt to help move the bill along. It's not to be hostile to it in any ways.
Oh, and
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and Senator Moi has been a champion to try to help move the bill forward. Mr. Chairman and Senator Moi, I apologize because in your committee, I don't believe that I fully understood exactly what it was that we were doing. I'm not an attorney.
I have a better idea now of where we're headed with that. And Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate the committee's indulgence here this afternoon. I really appreciate it. We spent a little over four hours in Senator Moy's committee, not only talking about the implied consent, but other parts of the bill, too, and I think that we did really good work. But now reflecting back and after talking with law enforcement and prosecutors, this issue of implied consent, I think, has a lot of serious repercussions, not only fiscally, but also in the way that we approach DWI enforcement.
Thank you for the point.
Mr. Chairman, the decision is clearly the committee's. I know that I favor Senator Ingebrigtsen's amendment. But the other thing I want to say is that Mr. Sheridan and all the other people who came to speak about the implied consent and some other things, you know, these folks, they're professionals and they have a clear working knowledge of this, and their heart is in the right place. Just as the representative, Mr. Palm from MAD, or Mr. McCarthy, their hearts are all in the right place. We all want to do the right thing here. And, you know, any guidance that this committee can help us with here, I'd really appreciate it. I know how I feel. I think that Section 2 may not be needed, but I know that the other body is.
Okay.
The other body.
That's all. Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Just one more comment. The implied consent thing has been thrown around here now a lot, probably more than anything today that I've heard. If somebody wants to challenge the implied consent law, let's get it out there on a standalone bill and let's do it on its own merits. Seriously. But to be held hostage by somebody might be doing something with the implied consent law over what looks to be good legislation, let's not let that happen.
Further discussion, questions? Would you care to restate your...
No, we don't want to do this.
A5.
A5. Discussion on the A5 amendment. Hearing none, all those in favor of the A5 amendment, you're repealing or just...
Removes Article 2.
Yeah. Yeah, and others.
No, removes Article 2.
Just Article 2.
All right. All those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. I will say no.
Okay.
And
they adjourn.
No,
you
got
the
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate file 2741 as amended to be recommended to pass. We refer to the full committee on finance.
That's right.
All those in favor of that motion indicate by aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Nage. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Committee adjourned.
I'll get some cake.
Oh, you better.
You should have thought that.
I should have thought that before I
Before you introduced your amendment.
Oh, you're coming down.